Hello and welcome to another episode of the Canadian Podcow. My name's Andrew Campbell, joined by my, I said it before, Sarah, you're still my favorite co-host, Sarah Sash of BC.
So far, your only co-host on the podcast, so.
Doesn't matter. Only is not the same. It is favorite. So we are still in Newfoundland, Sarah, on location at the Dairy Farmers of Canada's annual general meeting.
So we just saw a great panel in the conference here, including a number of producers from all over the world talking about supply management, which of course is very interesting to our audience.
And so our episode today is to bring those three panelists on for everybody else to hear just what those perspectives are, whether it be in Australia, California, or Wisconsin.
Our first guest is Vice President of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau and a member of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Joe Bragger also served as President of the Rural Mutual Insurance Company Board of Directors.
Joe's also served on many committees and organizations, including Wisconsin Soybean Association and the Wisconsin Discovery Farms Steering Committee. He was recognized as the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association's Conservation Farmer of the Year. Joe Bragger, it's great to have you here in Canada, and it's great to have you on the Canadian Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Joe, first things first, let's talk about your farm. I always ask people this question. I understand you're not only a dairy farmer, but that Bragger Farms also raises poultry, crops, and trout?
Yep. Well, until this year. But anyways, yes. A little challenge with our department of natural resources. They did not deliver them to the farm this year. They thought it was too expensive, even though we volunteer it, and they dumped them in local streams right next to me instead. So we're working. It doesn't make sense. I know I see the look.
Sense at all. Yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes that's what happens. Yep. So we're trying to sort that out. But you're right, yes. We're located in western Wisconsin, which if you're at all familiar with the United States, it'd be called the Driftless Area that runs along that western part, eastern part of Minnesota, down into Iowa, characterized right where I live, fairly hilly. So that really defines the way the farm is situated. So we've got about 400 cows, but they're located on three farms. And we rent some of these facilities from farms that have left heifers on one, lower lactation cows on the other one, and we kind of rotate them all through. Very much modeled after the way we raise the poultry. The feed is all stored at one farm since they're real close, and then we just deliver and we only milk at those other farms. All the calves, the dry cows, all of that's at home. That way we can focus our efforts. And I got to be pretty clear, otherwise I'll get in trouble. It's actually my wife that runs the poultry operation. She has 32,000 pullets that is raised under contract with Pilgrim's Pride.
That kind of clarity is deeply important.
There we go, because in case she hears this, I wanted to say it. And then we also have my brother, who farms with me, has two broiler barns. And then, of course, we do the standard crops for the dairy. But, you know, you heard about sustainability today. We do a lot with alternative cropping, trying to get millets and triticales and cover crops that are also feed crops. And so we do a lot of experimentation with that.
So now one of the things you mentioned in the panel today really was around, you know, what's happened with the Wisconsin dairy industry over the last couple of decades.
Well,
and 1996, the stat you used, 1996, there was what, 26,000 farms. Today there's what? And really the big question is like, how does that happen?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm so glad somebody heard me today. Yes, we had 26,000 dairy farms in 1996. Today, as of May, so I'm missing June, July, but we've lost farms since then. Wisconsin was down to 5,500 and I believe 45 or 48 dairy farms. You want to put that in the context, you know, when we had 26,000 dairy farms, we have less than that in the United States today. Right. So there's been a severe decline. Now, cows have not gone away. All right. They've just moved to other farms. And I'm often asked, well, but we're not losing cows. I said, I care about cows, but it's the families I care about. We want to see those farm families out there. We want to see them successful. That's the tax base that supports our communities. When those buildings, it's a kind of a sad statistic, but my son does excavating. He makes more money tearing down farms than building them up. Right, because the owner comes in, they just want to have the house, they want the rest of the land for recreation, and they want the old buildings gone. And in many cases, the last dollar has been taken out. because the maintenance starts lacking, you know, the first thing. And then you go right down my valley, it's sad. At the end of the driveway, I take people on that little tour because I live off the farm, just on our little second farm. Go down the road, there's just a house standing where there was once an entire farmstead. You go to the next place, three children grew up there, they were my age. They all supported to get off to college to do all of that stuff. It was a very pristine, nice farm. That has, the cows have left. Probably 10 years ago now, and the place is in complete decline. And little by little, that's what you're seeing out there. And so the support that we have for the communities then really starts to disappear. Because when you think about, you probably don't think about when you run to the hardware store for a few bolts, order some tin, you get that paint, all of those little things that happen every day, the impact that has on the local community.
Well, 26,000 farmers doing that, yeah. 5,000 farmers. Yeah. That's a lot less hardware stores, a lot less everything.
The implements, you think of all of that stuff. You know, in the heyday where everybody had 2 or 3 chopper boxes, we don't even see them anymore. They're gone. So, yeah,
well, that's such a change. A huge human side to this industry, not just on the farm, like you're saying, but all around. And with many others, you've worked on developing the dairy revitalization plan that could help better align and coordinate the dairy supply chain to try to bring some gusto, I guess. I don't know what, I didn't want to use the word life, but bring something back to your industry. Tell us more about that plan.
Okay, well, I'll go back to when some Canadian farmers came down to Wisconsin and talked about your system up here. Then I started in my role as being a district director for Wisconsin Farm Bureau at that time, started getting phone calls. Why aren't we doing that here? Why aren't we doing this? And so we started looking at it, especially when you consider our state is somewhat divided. And it's really kind of divided, even in Wisconsin, on the issue where I described that western part of the state where we have a lot of smaller farms. And we see a lot of our growth to the central part of the state and the eastern part of the state. And a lot of that's driven by topography, right? You're going to want to consider your water resources, your lay of your land. All those things are very important. Even in the United States, we see a shift out of the southeast because it's just warming up and getting too humid, so cows don't do well. So they're trying to move them to drier places where the sprinklers and so forth work. But we got together and we started looking at, and just I'll just say it, the word quota always comes up very taboo. It gets everybody's dander up right away. So that's when then supply management started coming along, growth management, because that's really what the Dairy Revitalization Plan is. As Lynn said earlier, it really tries to, you know, when we have to grow, we can grow. But when we shouldn't grow, we're disincentivized. So while it's, you would have, and this was a concept that you could move some dials on it, but we kind of set it in. I'll give you an example. So if you're a dairy farm and you are within your allowable limits of production, and if you want to grow, you can grow, but you need to pay a market access fee. That market access fee would be collected and then divided out among everybody else who didn't grow. Kind of, we're giving you market access. I'm not going to take that. You take that, but then that goes back into the rest. And you would pay that in the year you expanded. And it would be tiered for different expansion levels because we all know the biggest expansion have the largest impacts. So you're trying to steady that growth. And it really showed some positive things. And I know in relative to our prices, you're going to say, well, that isn't that much. But $1.42 at the level we had set increased to the farmers. But to me, that would be a substantial amount on our farm compared to pricing we have. It would really level out the prices that we have. And the increase, because you worry about increase to consumers, it was really marginal, 15 cents on a gallon of milk, right? When you've seen bigger swings than that all day long, maybe not up here, but in the stores, you know, when our price goes up, it goes well above that. So that's a very marginal increase, probably driven by not having waste. Because that's something I admire about your system. You know, when we have excess milk, and what do we try to do? We sell it, get in trouble with everybody. But going for that export market with the lowest quality stuff that you have, and you're just trying to shove dry powder out on the world, that's not bringing huge value back to our farm. That's not a woo, this is a joy, this is a necessity. Because if we don't move it, we don't know where we're going to go with it. Okay, so having no waste, you talk about sustainability, having that supply chain aligned actually resulted in minimal increase to consumers. Even we look at exports, because we always have to talk about the export side of things. Our export, when they ran the model, kept on the same trajectory. I'll admit it didn't go as high, but it stayed on the same trajectory. So there was no major loss of exports, because that's the first complaint you'll hear from many. Well, we got to have our export market. Yeah, I know we do, because otherwise we'll be swimming in milk.
Yeah. So, but then, because when you tie that back to all of those farms that you lost, and correct me if I'm wrong, I would guess a lot of them would be those smaller and medium-sized operations through Wisconsin. Would something like that help solve their challenge? Do you think that... well, as Sarah said, you know, maybe it's not necessarily brings life back to it, but sustains and stabilizes that decrease, especially in small and medium?
Especially when we take some of them extreme swings out, and we even that playing field a little bit. My neighbor, so we had a 400 to 500 cow dairy, so that's not a 10,000, but in our area, that's a good-sized dairy. Mm-hmm. They sold the cows this year. It had an immediate impact on the man down the road. Mm-hmm. Who had 60 cows, mm-hmm. because that 60 cow dairy was balancing the load off the 500. You see, when we start losing that infrastructure, we start losing all of those other little things you didn't imagine. I was in that other man's barn when he was crying because he was already only getting $12 a hundredweight, and now they were going to increase his hauling on top of it. So when we can do those things, definitely we can make a difference. Mm-hmm.
So as you move forward with your advocacy, what do you see as the most pressing issues facing dairy farmers today?
Well, it's going to be our pricing, our stability. Right now, you heard it today, our system, which was very fascinating. I'm sorry, I sat at the table this morning, and I was listening to how the work goes in to establish a price for dairy, right? Well, we kind of have the same thing, but we don't open it up very often. It's called the Federal Milk Marketing Orders. But you know who it increases the price for? The processor, right? And I actually have to pay it. Yeah. And I just cannot stress that enough. I don't want to go back and bring back to the question. But if we incentivize more production, but we don't have a home for it, we prolong the problem. Mm-hmm. The market doesn't clear. We were used to be great. We always heard about the cheese caves, you know. Well, they put butter and cheese away in storage. Well, what does that do? You got to take that out of storage someday, right? So now instead of clearing the market, if we want to really be free market, we're not clearing it. We're extending that depression of price. Mm-hmm. So it's a really convoluted system. We say we want a free market system, but it's still regulated, but not always to the benefit and the unity of the farmers coming together. And if you talk about big hurdle is getting unity among farmers. That is it. And I know, because we're all independent, right? But we could go so far. We had the thing on sustainability. That's on everybody's topic. Mm-hmm. But I was very pleased today to hear it. I hope people are not afraid to say that profitability has to be there for the producer. Because if we can't be profitable, we can't do those practices. We can't improve our practices. And we're always afraid to say it. Mm-hmm. We should be proud to find a way to be profitable, to support our community, support our churches, whatever you want to support, mm-hmm. and be a proud member of that community.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the fact that you need producers to come together to all believe in that, and that's one battle, I'm sure.
Small ask.
All of us can agree, can't we? Yeah. Tell me how you get along with that. But you also need government on side.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about those conversations with government. How do you go forward to also make sure that are they supportive of a plan like this? And can you actually get something like that done?
So it goes right back to the same thing. And I'm not sure if it's an easy answer, but if you talk to someone, whether it's a congressman or otherwise, their ask is come to us with a unified plan. That's the message. We got a great idea, but we need a unified plan. And so that just goes back to developing that unity. There is so much supply management going on in the United States, but uncoordinated. I talked about the individual processor saying, you can't ship anymore, we won't take anybody on. But even within that, it's always amazing how some guys still manage to grow. Right? So it's unevenly applied, but unity among farmers is vital in moving anything forward.
big word for us. When we're sitting in the presentation and you said unity, I was like, yep. And you could feel the whole room just in the same kind of way. I just wanted to touch on one more bit before we let you go, and that is regarding sustainability. You've got quite a stack of awards regarding sustainability and conservation. And I was just curious to you, how important is sustainability in modern dairy farming? And I guess we've touched a little bit on the economic side. I mean, you've got to be economically sustainable, or this isn't even a discussion. But in terms of the on-farm practices, what do you believe are essential for achieving sustainability?
So the on-farm practices, and I'm going to qualify this one thing. What sustainability and the environmental practices that I use, those are what I use. Every farm has to identify the practice, number one, that's necessary to do, that's reasonable to do, and that's achievable. If they can't do those things, and just hear what Joe Brager does on his farm, and it doesn't work, it's no good, right? But in our hilly area, we use no-till, we use cover crops heavily, those different, we try to keep it green. We actually apply rye to our soybeans before they're, right before the leaves drop. We go out that little bitty track, that little bit of soybean I run down, it'll be fine because we've got slopes, 20%, 30% slopes, so we do everything to protect that. I once thought, we always use, I'm not sure if you use that metric up here, but it's called tolerable soil loss, or T. And that can be, I guess it's, you know, it's like a few sheets of paper thickness across the landscape would be, and it's measured in tons, all right? I never thought it was possible to get to 3T. Now we can do tenths of a T with the practices when we layer them. So it changes. And then when you look at that on our farm, we, the Discovery Farms, let me quick explain that. That was on-farm environmental research we did with the University of U.S. Geological Service. And we had in-stream monitors right on our farm. So you could capture from two different, mostly non-ag side, wooded, and then the agriculture side. And then we measured for so many years, and then we came up with best management practices to address whatever we would find. What we did find that was fascinating, that with the practices in place then, which were less than we have today, we were capturing all but 2% of the annual precipitation, never left the farm. So when you talk about capturing that kind of water and keeping it on the farm, those are impressive because they help crop production as well, and it leads to the profitability. But it all takes time.
Well, Joe, it's one thing that I've followed along in a lot of the discussions that have happened in Wisconsin, and it's clear you're an incredible advocate for the dairy farmers in your region and for the dairy industry as a whole. So thanks for all of your work, and thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our next guest today has over 30 years of experience in all facets of agricultural and farm policy with a specific focus on dairy policy.
Lynn McBride's career started at the National Farmers Union in Washington, D.C., where she served in government relations, representing the Organization on Farm Policy, Trade, Renewable Energy, Environmental, and Rural Development Issues. Sounds like all of them. her participation in numerous international meetings included the World Food Summit and farmer meetings worldwide, enabling her to gain knowledge of global agricultural issues.
Since relocating to California in 1999, she has been pivotal at the California Dairy Campaign and California Farmers Union, serving as their executive director.
It's great to have Lynn McBride on the Canadian Podcow in Newfoundland today. Thanks for joining us, Lynn.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
So first of all, if we could jump right into it, can you tell us a little bit more about California, the California Dairy Campaign?
Sure. So we started over 30 years ago, and so we represent family dairy farmers throughout the state of California. And one of our core principles when we started that many years ago was dairy supply management, which now we call dairy growth management. So we just think it makes sense to balance milk supply with profitable market demand because it leads to more stable milk prices paid to dairy farmers and improved prices paid to dairy farmers. Right now, U.S. dairy farmers are on, one dairy farmer told me, a roller coaster ride on steroids as it relates to milk pricing, and they want to get off. They want some more stability and certainty. And so we think that, again, incentivizing this balance is going to get them there.
Well, certainly when you do talk about that roller coaster ride on steroids,
you know, sounds fun as an entertainment ride when it's your livelihood.
Exactly.
You know, obviously it's a different story. So then how many producers does the CDC represent then?
Yeah, so we represent 150 dairy farmers across California. Unfortunately, many of our leadership has, a number of our leaders have left the dairy sector just because of the volatility that I've just described. So in California, you know, there's about 1,140 dairies across the state, and I think in terms of owners, it's less, you know, around 900 or so. So the numbers are definitely declining. The milk cow numbers are staying the same, so it's just becoming more consolidated and concentrated in California, and then we've seen that also around the country. So again, we think if we had a more balanced approach where we had more stable prices, you wouldn't see sort of these medium and small-sized dairy farmers go out of business at the alarming rate that they are. And so that's why we've been supportive of dairy growth management and part of the Dairy Together effort, which is a nationwide effort since it was founded now more than 5 years ago, just to really amplify the message that we need to change direction in dairy policy in the United States, not just produce as much milk as possible, chasing an export market because it's causing so many dairy farmers to go out. Instead, we need to have a growth management plan and really, produce milk for the market.
So I was going to ask you some more about some of the things you've done to testify before your different departments of agriculture and food, advocating for your position, but I think you've touched on it more, growth management. What does your position there include, and how would you describe growth management further?
Yeah, so we did participate in the recent United States Department of Agriculture federal order hearing because we think it directly pertains to our campaign to establish growth management. In our federal order system, dairy farmers pay dairy processors amount of money to process their milk. This hearing is recommending that that amount increase. So we're concerned if that much farmer money is going to the milk processor, that milk processor is going to be less responsive to changes in profitable market demand, which are critical because any even small imbalance has huge implications for the farmer milk price, and usually it leads to a price decrease. And so what we aim to do with our dairy growth management plan is to call on Congress to pass an incentive-based approach so that we balance milk production with profitable market demand and that we get away from this make allowance structure that's making our processing plants less responsive to changes in demand, because it's the farmer at the end of the day who pays for that imbalance.
So how are those conversations going then? Like, can you get that? Can you achieve that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they're challenging just because of how our current system is working, and some of our members would argue it's not working for farmers. So we just continue to put the solution out there. I think 2023 was a really difficult year for farmers because the price was below production costs. Our U.S. government was sending out checks to dairy farmers to cover these losses in all but 1 month of 2023. So you look at that price tag and know that all that money that went out didn't really do anything to save any farmers. We still saw dairy farmers go out. And so we just think it makes more sense to balance milk production with profitable market demand so that we don't have these government expenditures that aren't helping farmers, are costing taxpayers, and are just paying into a failing system. Instead, we think if we had the right incentives in place and farmers were matching their milk production with profitable market demand, we wouldn't need these taxpayer handouts. So we're hopeful that as we continue to have this conversation, as well as we're reaching out to consumers as well to explain to them that it's important to have a stable, secure milk supply, and that it would benefit them as well for this roller coaster ride to stop happening, because we did see big spikes in the volatility, and consumer prices tend to go up. They don't tend to go down as quickly as they ramp up. And so that, obviously has an impact on demand, which again comes back to the dairy farmer. We just think it's a more sensible approach to plan for growth.
Well, it sounds very much like you're still advocating at this. You've been at it for a while. Can you speak to what the barriers are? What's holding back the eventual adoption of this or the continuation of your request?
Yeah, I think a lot of interest further up the food chain, like cheap milk. I mean, that's just really the biggest obstacle that we continue to face. But what we found is that as we work with farmers who are also part of their farm cooperatives, and you know, the majority of the milk in the United States is marketed through farm cooperatives, the more we explain to them the benefits of this system, the more they are reaching out to their cooperative leadership to call for a change in direction that would ensure there's profitability on the farm side as well as the processor side.
Talk maybe a little bit too about that, you know, kind of trying to get government on side with it. Obviously, and you know, we talked to Joe just before, and he was talking about the challenge of bringing farmers together too. Like, how can you kind of unite farmers in wanting this as well? What's that discussion like? Do all farmers in California look forward to this, or is that also a process to convince them that this is the best for the industry?
Yeah, I think that's an ongoing process and challenge too. And, you know, we've pointed out to them that our government's already involved in the milk supply. Some of the reluctance is they don't want, you know, a strong government oversight. But right now our government is already, you know, paying out to certain farmers based on their herd size when prices drop. Other herd sizes, that is not covered. They're, you know, they're the make allowance structure that I talked about. So they're very much having a role. But we just think that it's important for them to, you know, step back and provide the incentives that farmers need so that they're responding to these market signals, because very small changes in either demand or supply have a huge implication for milk prices. But I think there's been extensive research done by Cornell University, the University of Wisconsin. Once farmers understand the benefits of this system in their milk check, it makes more sense to them to really advocate for it. One of the challenges is, you know, emboldening farmers to speak up to their leadership. But I think the more farmers do it, the easier it is for other farmers to do it. It sort of has a snowball effect.
Chicken or egg problem.
Yeah.
Who's gonna come first.
Yeah. You only need one other person with you in a room, usually, at these meetings, and it makes a world of difference. I mean, I know you talked to Joe Berger earlier, but he's been one who has stood up at these meetings as a farmer and had someone. You just need at least one person with you. It can't just be one farmer. And then then people start listening, and it starts to make sense. Some of the challenges, and I'm sure he described this because I've experienced it too, you go and you talk about growth management and how important it is. The meeting's over and then everyone's in the hall talking to you about how they support it, but they're nervous about bringing it up because they don't feel like they're expert enough. And that's what we've done in the United States. We've made our milk pricing system so complicated. Dairy farmers don't feel like they're equipped to speak about it, which is absolutely ridiculous because it's their milk check. And so they should speak about it as much as they possibly can. So that's what we're trying to do, is make it more transparent and give dairy farmers the information they need. It's not that complicated. We need to balance supply and demand. We need to figure out incentives to get us there. And there's a path to that. We also are part of a monthly milk pricing survey where we have dairy farmers report their milk pricing each month. When we started that survey, we had a lot of dairy farmers saying, well, I don't know how to report this. What information do you need? And now it's just so automatic. And now everyone wants a copy of the survey. And now they understand you give them the information, they will run with it. But it's that comfort level, the feeling like they know enough to be able to make a statement. And I've always felt that dairy farmers are the experts. And so they really do need to be speaking up and part of the conversation, leading the conversation, actually. And I've gotten in trouble with people in the United States about this, but I've always thought that, you know, in terms of experts that, you know, aren't farmers, the only real experts are in Canada because they know how to pay their farmers. Unfortunately, I don't win over crowds there, but maybe here.
Over here, you'll be fine.
So you've been here throughout the conference, and there's been a lot of talk about sustainability, and I've been pleased to hear that economic sustainability has been included in those conversations, because at times, as a farmer myself, it feels like it's all about other types of sustainability, and running the business is very important. But I'm curious, in California, what it's like in terms of those other sustainability measures outside of economic. How are you keeping those going amid all of these cost challenges that you're facing?
Yeah, I mean, California has a really aggressive target, which is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for dairy by 40% by 2030. So that's really around the corner. The good news is we're on track to do it. But what we've brought up to our state lawmakers is basically, you know, here's our milk price. If you guys want us to make these improvements, you're going to have to provide the resources necessary to get there. So we've been fortunate in that our state, you know, in years past, now we're in a tough budget year in California, has provided grants to dairy farmers so that they can make changes to their manure nutrient management practices that have big impacts on their greenhouse gas emissions. There's been dairy digesters, which I know speaking to folks at the conference, it's happening in Canada as well. And then we also want to make sure there's practices that work for all size dairies, because some of the expense required in a digester is too much for a smaller dairy farm. So we've been part of this alternative manure management program, which just basically changes your manure strategies so that you can reduce your methane emissions by up to 90%. So those show great promise, but the struggle is always in financing these changes. And so we continue to advocate at the state level and at the federal level. If we want to make these changes, we need to make sure the farmers have the resources to get there. They're interested in doing it. They want to make these changes, but when you're losing money or when there's this tremendous volatility, and that's actually happened in California, when different companies have come and said, hey, would you like to put in a digester? And they say, well, you need a 10-year commitment. And then you're talking to someone who's looking at his phone to see what the cheese price did that day or the butter price. I mean, there's just so much uncertainty and instability that it makes it hard for them to make the investments. So I think that would also benefit not only, you know, growth management, having more stable prices would benefit the climate and the environment as well, because dairy farmers would be able to make those investments or more able.
Yeah.
But we do think it's important for government to fill that gap and provide those resources, because in California, we have these aggressive strategies for climate and other environmental goals, but we continue to see our herd size, the numbers shrink, and the sizes grow. And you talk to someone, you know, like Joe in Wisconsin, and he'll say, what? How many dairies do you have and how big are they? And will other farmers in the rest of the United States really want to follow that path when they understand what happens when farms leave local communities? It has a ripple effect on all the businesses and can really depress those areas. So we want to make sure there's strategies in place so that, and I have talked to folks at this conference that talked about, you know, smaller scale digester development, making that a reality. We've brought up this issue for many years in California, and the response has been, oh, we're getting to you. But unfortunately, we need that to happen now, especially with this mandate happening. And also, you know, the profit opportunity that's apparent by these systems. If you're able to show these greenhouse gas reductions and these environmental benefits, there's an ability to provide a revenue stream. And we want to make sure all dairies of all sizes have that ability.
Well, it was a really informative panel today, and we just appreciate you, Lynn, coming on the podcast to share it with everybody else in the country. So thanks, Lynn McBride.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
Meet a Canadian dairy farmer. Planting one tree, then hundreds more. To naturally purify the air. Preserving wildflowers for pollinators. And nurturing wetlands for healthier soil so wildlife can prosper.
Biodiversity is in our nature.
Working towards a sustainable future. That's Dairy Farming Forward.
We're in!
Our next guest is an Australian dairy farmer who's been on cooperative boards since his mid-30s and chaired a major national supply cooperative of 1,000 suppliers. 5 years ago, Ian Zanstra was appointed the New South Wales Fresh Milk and Dairy Advocate, and he joins us now. Ian Zanstra, welcome to the Canadian PodCow.
Hello there.
So let's talk about, we talked to Joe and Lynn, a lot about what this, looked like for the panel. But I'm curious, one of the things that I really want to know before we get into all of that is about you and the farm at home.
Well, I don't milk the cows anymore. I have a share farmer there, and he milks 1,000 cows. We own the property, of course, and we went share farming so I could keep the property, keep what I'd worked for all my life. rather than say, well, where does this go now, and cash it in.
And why was that important?
Well, after you worked all your life to get there and starting from nothing and wanting land and wanting to be a dairy farmer, very strong emotional attachment.
Well, that emotional attachment must be even higher, I think, because I've talked to other farmers through Australia, and that big conversation is, what was that deregulation process like? And I think, you know, that fight that you must have gone through, you know, all those years as it went through, that's really what I'm kind of curious to hear a little bit more about. But maybe start about what kind of current conditions look like for a dairy farmer in Australia.
Well, the industry has shrunk since the year 2000 or thereabouts, from 12 billion to 8 billion litres. The number of farmers from nearly 14,000 to 4. So the industry still exists, and there is market there and processes and products. But just by that little analysis, the industry is shrinking, and there must be a lot of pain there. But as a farmer, ongoing farmer, you're doing your stuff and you think it's all right. But farmers have left and are still leaving, and virtually no new entrants. There's a bit of corporate activity, and there has been in the past, and they haven't necessarily done so well. So mainly it's to do with the cost base, the high cost, and we've had a long period of no increase in domestic pricing due to retailer muscle and the processes with brands, which is their support, it's their big play, being uncompetitive. The retailer brands are that cheap, the processors can't go for the money they need, which would enable them to pay farmers the money they probably think the farmers need to stay in business. It's changed now due to a shortage of milk. Milk prices have gone up in some areas, are as high as Canada's. So you don't have to be regulated to get a deserving price. Supply and demand will do that, and you probably don't realise that's what you're seeing because you're calling it supply management, but it might just be the value landscape because you're here and you're in the different states and you've got to pay good money to have the milk in those localities. So economically it's correcting itself somewhat in Australia, but processes are still falling and failing. Saputo is over there, has bought in rather big scale, but they will be suffering the same pressures of the export players in the south. Fonterra, I hope your listeners have heard of Fonterra, the big New Zealand player, it wants out. Wow. So we think it's a normal market with milk and farmers and products and market, but there are strains there.
And clearly, you know, through that whole deregulation process, there still is a lot to be figured out in terms of how do you stabilize every player in the dairy sector, yeah, not just one or the other. So maybe talk a little bit about that process, that because you did have a supply management and then it was pulled away. Talk a little bit about what happened over all those subsequent years, particularly for the farmer.
Well, supply management talk and changing it probably started at 1985, but certainly by 1993 through government competition reviews and also trying to comply with world trade terms. Not definite yet, but if you're going to play in the international market, you've got to be internationally competitive. So that pressure was coming from the government people and certainly then the bureaucrats and then the economists who talked about efficiency and competitiveness, somewhat divorced from the reality. I mean, you mentioned to me ideology, but also you might say understanding from academics, that it had to change. And it came on its way, most definitely, but 10 years of talk and counter-talk and arguments and case and yes and no and it went on for 10 years. Every argument and bit of rhetoric you can imagine was thrown into the mix for and against. And I think the farming community and the farmer leaders probably thought it wouldn't come ahead because it didn't pass the public good test to dismantle regulation. But eventually, through market factors, and that was the big pool of export milk that wanted to have better money terms, and they saw that the regulated farmers had it. So it was haves and have-nots, about 18% of Australia's milk was market milk. The rest was export, cheaper. Price comparison of, say, 45 cents to 21. Everyone understands the pressure of that differential. So that, in the end of the day, plus the political reasons for doing it, competition policy and so on, pulled it apart.
So then can you give me a bit of perspective? Because that talks a little bit about what Joe and Lynn both talked about in terms of, you know, farmers really needing to unite to be able to move policy. And in that situation, you've got two groups of farmers that are basically not together in any sense and battling it out. Here in Canada, I think there is, a sense very much so that, among farmers, supply management does work for farmers, but the industry as a whole. I'm curious your perspective kind of from the outside looking in. What do you think about Canadian supply management?
Well, I think, why would you risk dismantling it? Because a lot of us didn't see the chaos that occurred. I was on a cooperative board, a processor board, and I later chaired a supply cooperative. So I was there in the thick of it. I've talked to the chairs of the many small cooperatives that made dairy farmers. We all knew it was coming, but we didn't see it happening. Now, what we didn't see happen was the competition, even of some of our milk, of this industrial milk being produced, being a value of that to farmers, farmers looking for a better place, even if it took over the space of fluid milk. So the competition, even from the farming community through their processes, and some farmers left their processes and went to the market themselves. Yeah, there was a strong price competition because of this big pool of industrial milk. And then the processors saw their economic base weakened and they started competing amongst themselves. And then the retailers took advantage of the milk pool and got contracts for low ball contracts for packaged milk. And willingly from the processors, because if you didn't, in our case, if you didn't get a contract like that, what would you do with the farmer's milk? But then they put it on the shelf at a very low price. And the argument then, it's loss leading, they're just using it as a gimmick, it's people through the stores, went on, and that's where they were playing. And they played there actually for 18 years.
It's a long time to fight.
A long time, yeah. And that decimated the farmers over time. It decimated the processors. Dairy farmers itself couldn't last the distance. The biggest processor spread over a very big area in all of Eastern Australia. That was the big cooperative that put itself together to handle this. Unite all the farmers and all the small cooperatives, have big national presence, be able to deal and even have barriers to entry for others, because we had the products, we had the location, we had the scale, we could get the best deal with the retailer. Well, we did, but it wasn't good enough. And then the battle amongst the processors was on. We had takeover bids from the other two big ones. We made processor bids on them. Fonterra entered and bid for all players. Not all were successful, but we eventually restructured to get capital and eventually were sold within 8 years. Couldn't get the capital, so a corporate can get the capital. And we were bought by Kirin from Japan. They had the capital, but they didn't last anyway. But they had the ability to survive write-offs. It's all on the books. It wasn't as if they couldn't go to banks or threatened by ratios. But eventually they left. And Parmalat went broke internationally, which became Lactalis. They left. One of the big cheesemakers, Warrnambool Cheese and Butter Cooperative, was bought by Saputo. That was all fine. That was a strong business. Murray Goulburn, the biggest cooperative of 3.6 billion litres, folded after a restructure attempt with outside capital. It was chaos. So I can say now, the industry's there. What am I talking about? But it's from 8 billion, 12 billion to 8, and a lot of hurt amongst the farmers, and a tough time.
Mm-hmm. A tough time for sure. And you talked about, you know, earlier about the challenges that, that you are facing in terms of just trying to improve that margin for processors so that processors can then, you know, pay a better price to, you know, producers consistently. You know, you have the title of dairy advocate. You must still have optimism for what dairy is and does and where it can play a role globally.
Yeah, well, have I optimism? For 4 years, it was very tough for me, but I got through. So did many other farmers, of course. I sometimes thought, geez, I just should sell the cows and go beef, but I had good dairy country. I then had optimism for myself, but not for the industry, and that was strange to address in conversation. But I knew with my farming approach of low cost, and I credit it to the New Zealand model, you know, and grass, like, I realised I could stick it out, yeah. Optimism for the industry. As a dairy advocate, we had to address the noise in New South Wales from the farmers. We had two farmer advocacy groups battling themselves for space, wanting to be on the pulpit, you know, just... And advocacy failed because they weren't elected people. You get the era of the self-appointed and the self-anointed. And some of these people failed to be leaders in the previous structure. Now, if you've got leaders, you've got to have a process of developing leaders, and they're sorted out by the democratic process, the right people who you want to represent you. So we had this contest of I call it industry noise, and it wasn't good for the politicians because they couldn't handle it. And they were getting calls for re-regulation, floor price schemes, national pooling, all this stuff, you know, as a solution. The solution was we were having droughts and hard times, and that's a difficult time for farmers. And no price lift because the processors were constrained by their lack of margin, and the retailers were keeping the price where it was, and brands couldn't really deliver what they normally do because they're premium. So my appointment was a political appointment, but not for political reasons, you might say, appointed by the government to address this noise in one way, because these other parties wanted a dairy commissioner with statutory powers. And I was on one committee where they were lobbying for that. And I said, well, I'm not part of this. And eventually I was nominated and had a different role. So no statutory powers, appointed by the government. Very ingenious model, because a lot was expected from it in this dairy commissioner's advocacy, tell the government what to do. Well, it wasn't made that way, thankfully. A panel was appointed of 12 very experienced industry people, with our vets, previous extension people, university professors, with this government oversight, like a lot of department support, bureaucratic support, doing the writing and taking it down and this sort of stuff. Yeah, recommendations were made as to what the government could do to support dairy, which is what it's about. Mm-hmm. And no mucking around in the market, because you'll get nowhere and it'll... And I knew it would sort itself out. The supply and demand, that nasty word, would eventually address this milk shortage. So, yeah, as dairy advocate, we saw, we heard and knew of the problem of disgruntled farmers. Not everyone was disgruntled, but the squeaky wheel makes the noise. And the politicians, well, didn't like that, because they were held up to do something about it, and they did. So from that came a lot of recommendations, and it's being enacted upon. There's a program called Dairy Up that run by the Sydney University that handles a lot of those recommendations about support for the industry. And they might be such things like there's a big program about education regarding house cows, which is very unusual for us and very new and happening. Another program with financial support for intensification, which to a lesser degree than house cows, is feed pads and big feed bunkers. So securing feed. there's been very good money for support from the fires and the floods, and the government has poured a lot of money into supporting dairying again.
Well, it certainly does sound like good news that you're moving forward in that, but we definitely appreciated your perspective here today on what that has looked like over the last number of years and your support for Canadian supply management. But biggest of all, like, all you have to do is look at a Globian and like you, the thank you for traveling from New South Wales to St. John's, because I'm not sure you'll ever travel further in your life.
That's right.
But Ian Zantra, thanks for joining the podcast today.
Well, I'm very pleased to do it, and I still think a lot about this and the industry generally. It's great.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of the Canadian Podcast.
Huge thanks again to our production team, Carl Bellanger and Bruce Sargent, and of course, to our sponsor, Dairy Farmers of Canada.
And of course, on top of that, a huge thanks to everybody here in Newfoundland and Labrador for all the hospitality at the annual general meeting. If you've got any thoughts, comments, ideas, you can always look us up at canadianpodcow.ca. And of course, we'd love if you subscribe too, Sarah.
That's perfect. Catch you next time.